Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
Being a servant in the late Victorian and early 20th century was nothing like Downton Abbey or Upstairs Downstairs. Servants were wheels in a vast machine with no personality of their own. They often had to face a wall when their master or mistress walked by. Or they were a house parlourmaid who was a skivvy, maid and cook all in one, heaving coal and water and working most hours of the day. Our guest today is the award-winning author Lucy Lethbridge, who has explored the world of British servants and uncovered the truth about servants' class and their tricky relationship. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, the author of Servants, Lucy Lethbridge. Hello.
Hello, very nice to be here.
It's a pleasure. So tell us about being a servant in an Edwardian grand house.
Well, in an Edwardian grand house, you'd rather lucked out on the servant scale because... on the whole, you were pretty comfortable, as viewers of Downton will know. You were fed very well, certainly would be far better than any food you'd have had at home. You also had the opportunity to meet people. And although the work was hard, one of the things that is really striking to me, anyway, about service in the early 20th century was that for most servants who worked as single-handed maids in a middle-class household, it was the loneliness that was so striking. So if you worked in a large house, there was a constant flow of men. There were opportunities to get married. You had servants' dances. You had the village. So in that sense, it was rather more, we would think of as a slightly sort of more full-on office, a kind of 24-hour, round-the-clock office life. So in that sense, as well as the opportunities for training and for going up the ladder, it wasn't a bad life.
What was bad about it?
Well, by modern day standards, you were not free. I mean, the deference would grate today. You know, a lot of servants chafed at having to call children, for example, the children of the house, master and miss, when they themselves were referred to perhaps by their surname or just by a generic name like Mary Ann. And you weren't free. I mean, your life was very constrained by, in the case of a very large house, the sort of Mrs. Hughes figures, and you know, the housekeeper or the butler who held the rules, so that, you know, if you wanted to go out for an evening, they would probably wait up and check you were in by 10. So these kind of things. But these are things that chafe us now. But I think in 1900, most girls, for example, would have come from homes which were like that too. So it wouldn't have felt quite as extraordinary as it does to us now.
What did you have to sacrifice to be a servant?
Well, on the whole, if you were a servant, you didn't really have any choices. I mean, most people, I don't think, chose to be servants because it was a lifetime's vocation. They went into service because there was very little else for working class young people to do. And the only options for a working class girl were factories. And factories were often frowned upon by the respectable working class. They were thought to be rather sort of brash and loud, sort of places where there was sort of uncontrolled, rather vulgar behaviour. And service was considered a good career because it was safe, it was secure. And you sent your girl out into the world knowing that to an extent she would be looked after. It was called getting your feet under somebody else's table. And for poor families, of course, that was terribly important because, you know, to protect your children, to make sure they were safe, you had to make sure that they were in a position where someone was looking after them.
How many people in the UK were servants at the kind of turn of last century?
Well, I don't know the precise number, but it was certainly comprised about half of the female workforce. So it would have been over 1 million. I mean, there were fewer men servants by that time. At one point in the 18th century, service was mainly men. In the 19th century, that changed. I think there are lots of reasons for this. I think partly it's because service itself became viewed as slightly degrading and unmanly. and working class men began to chafe at it. Also because I think there were, after the Industrial Revolution, there were a lot more women going out to work. So you got sort of many more women in paid employment, and even if the only paid employment available was service. And so you get a shift between the man, from the manservant to the parlourmaid, and most houses would have had women servants rather than men servants.
So what sort of people, you said working class people came servants, but what sort of characteristics would they have? You know, I mean, would they be kind of conservative? You know, what sort of people?
Well, I think because it wasn't a choice, you'd have as much a variety as you would in any other job. Because, I mean, the only people I think who felt that service might be a career and therefore you can ascribe to them a particular character are butlers. Mm-hmm. And I was very interested when I was writing my book at how butlers in their memoirs and when you hear them recorded in interviews and so on, they do conform to the stereotype much more. So I don't think I can talk about a stereotypical maid.
So tell us a typical butler then.
Well, a butler, there's that sort of lugubrious tone. Anyone who's read Remains of the Day will know there's that sort of tremendously sort of deferential, slightly pompous reticence, that desire to do everything to perfection. And I mean, it's what we would now call great managerial skills in many ways, because and modern butlers, of course, are called household managers, and that it is a skilled job. You're running a household, but they are the ones, I think, who the particular kind of men who desired to be butlers do have certain characteristics. They're generally rather conservative. They generally at home with sort of hierarchies. They like the order of things as it is. They like each man and his degree, and they don't much like change. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that is a feature. So if you were a young man of that kind of, with that sort of bent, then butlering would be quite a good job for you.
I mean, in Downton Abbey, you know, the man's had a past. Do you think you could have, you know, he used to work in music hall. Do you think you could have done other jobs and then become one, or did you work your way up?
Well, it's quite surprising. I must say that he had another job before he became a butler. I mean, I have to say that doesn't seem to me... there are many things in Downton Abbey that don't seem to me to be quite plausible. And I think that is... Carson's music hall past is one that doesn't feel to me quite right. Certainly most butlers, most career servants of the Mrs. Hughes, Carson variety, will have worked their way up from quite a lowly position in a large house where they had room to train. So most butlers started off as something like a hall boy, which is the person cleaning the shoes and, you know, sleeping in the hall.
And sleeping in the hall?
Yes, the little boy, you know, age 12. Or possibly a page boy.
Sleep on a windowsill or something, kind of window.
No, I think in the hall there were those sort of, you know, those hall benches. I think that they were for the hall boy to sleep on. Wow. Those big ones with high backs.
So they're always there? I mean, that's...
Yes, I think they were always there to unlock the door. They was there to, you know, if there was a... There was a presence in the hall. I mean, they were quite old-fashioned by 1900. They were a sort of 18th-century throwback. But nonetheless, that would be... If you were to start young and you would inch your way up and then become sort of second footman, first footman, under butler and butler. And you know, butlering was a very skilled role. It had a lot of skills involved in it. And you can see with Carson, he's a very good, if rather old-fashioned, manager of people.
Tell us a female journey. So that would be a male journey. What would be a female journey to get the top of her? Would the top of her tree be housekeeper?
Yes, I think of a career servant in a large country house, which of course is not really representative of the lives of most servants, but a career servant, yes, would go, or a cook.
Yeah,
you go in as a kitchen maid, and you end up as a cook, and a cook can earn good money like a butler. I mean, the top of the tree, a proper professional sought after cook, earned, I mean, far in excess of what most working women in, say, the 1920s were earning working as secretaries or things. So, you know, what you sacrificed for that as a cook was possibly the chance to get married. Not always, but it was difficult. You know, residential service, 24 hours, being sort of 24 hours on call, makes relationships difficult. It makes family life difficult. Often employers don't like you to be married because they don't want your loyalties to be divided. So someone like... the Downton cook, Mrs. Patmore. I mean, she's not a Mrs. She's an honorary Mrs. But, you know...
They did that a lot.
Yes, they did a lot with cooks. I don't know quite why cooks...
Probably sounded homely.
I think it sounded homely, and I think it accorded them a dignity by sort of pretending that they weren't spinsters. But in fact, actually, yes, you that was a sacrifice, I think, if you wanted to reach the top of the tree. But really, someone like Mrs. Patmore would probably be snapped up by an awful lot of people, and you get lots of letters about people poaching each other's cooks. You know, if there's a very famously good cook, offering them staggering amounts of money, really, to come and work for them. For other grand families. And so, but she would have started as a kitchen maid or even a scullery maid, just doing the washing up.
Wow.
And you can see, you know, then she become a Daisy figure.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's helping, and you see Daisy is gradually learning on the job.
Yeah.
And so in time, if Daisy wants to, she herself will be a fine cook. And in fact, she's already reached that point, hasn't she? She's been offered the work.
Yeah, I want to say that you did say that on call 24 hours a day. Is that true?
Well, I mean, not strictly. That's not strictly speaking. But in a sense, your hours were at the whim of your employer. So if they were having a dinner party, you couldn't go to bed until the washing up was done. So if they chose to stay up till 2 a.m, so did you. And you'd probably been up since 6. So it was that feeling. And of course, employers varied in their consideration. So some employers were very nice and will say, look, you know, go to bed early, or we mustn't stay up because it's not fair on the servants, or something like that. But some employers didn't care at all. And I think it was particularly hard for those in small households, you know, small cramped households, because you really, really did, you know, you were at the whim of their whim, and that must have been very difficult.
This is Mary Killen. I'd rather listen to Radio Gorgeous.
Why did other working class people look down on people that were servants? Because it did start in the book, start saying that, yeah, people were saying, oh, you're a skivvy and things like that.
Yes, they used to shout flunky in the street and skivvy and slavey. I think because the working class had become much more politicised in the late 19th century, early 20th century, the growth of the labour movement. There was far more a feeling, much more than we would realise by these rather rose-tinted Downton Abbey-type programmes. There was a real feeling of injustice. And the working classes were, you know, they were busy joining trade unions, they were busy learning their own rights, and domestic servants seemed to stand apart from that, and they seemed in fact to be underpinning the whole system. And of course it wasn't very fair on servants, because often they had no choice, they had to be servants, they hadn't done it because they wanted to underpin the system and they wanted to support the sort of hated aristocracy, but they were seen as propping it up. And also I think there was the idea that people who'd been in service for a long time adopted the sort of snobbery and manners of their employers.
Which I think it sounded like they did.
Well, I think they very often did, because they'd become accustomed to that kind of living.
Class rigour sort of thing.
Well, just a sort of style of living that had set them apart from their own class.
Yes, they'd know a bit more about wine and, yeah.
Well, that's right, and they would have sort of attitudes. They were very often conservative voters, so that they would often go back to... In retirement, they'd go back to the places they'd come from, and they wouldn't really fit in to the world in which they'd come from. Robert Roberts, who's a memoirist, writes very well about this, about the servants that came back to Salford when he was a child, who retired back where they'd come from. And they were loathed by their neighbours because they had sort of genteel airs.
Yes,
and they thought they were a bit superior and a cut above because they'd mingled.
Yeah.
So that caused problems.
Because they've changed, of course they had.
Yes.
Yeah. So what was the master and servant relationship like?
Well, it completely depended on the master. I mean, it didn't so much depend on the servant, because the servant didn't really have any say. I kept sort of swerving when I was writing this book for feeling absolutely outraged by the treatment of servants. And then I'd come across a really wonderful story and I'd feel, you know, completely the opposite. There's one lovely story of one little example in William Lanceley, who was a butler who wrote his memoir. And he writes about how the last words of her employer were to her maid, her long-standing maid of 60 years or something, and she said, take me in your arms, Marjorie. And I think that indicates a real depth of affection, that seemed to me. I mean, of course, in a way, it was depth of affection without real equality, which is quite difficult. But nonetheless, I think it was there.
I think that can work, though.
Oh, I think it can. And I think it can in a world where sort of hierarchies are understood. I think it would be more difficult to pull off today because we don't really. But I think no, absolutely, it can work.
People would know the expression; they know their place. So,
And I don't think they necessarily people didn't necessarily feel the kind of envy, I think, that we might expect now that is born out of more freedom.
Yeah, because we think we might be able to have it, whereas their sights were like, no, this is what I do, I'm going to be good at it.
I'm valued for it as well. And there was a sense. And so there's, and of course you're living in enormous intimacy with people.
God,
you know, because you're living, I mean, you're watching, you see your employer in their bath, you know. I mean, there's, I mean, far more intimacy than we would ever have with an employee now.
I mean, imagine if someone dressed you every day.
Dress, you do your hair, you've seen them. And if you live with them for many, many years, you see them, you grow old with them. So there are many examples like that. And then Margaret Powell, who many listeners will know, is a wonderful sort of feisty, furious memoirist of her life. She's fantastic. She wrote a book called Below Stairs, and she hated being a servant. But she does talk about this one family she went to work for called the Downings, Lord and Lady Downing. And it was the first time she'd been treated with real consideration. And she talks, for example, about for the first time meeting Lord Downing on the stairs, and she's terrified. She thinks that she's going to get told off because she's going up the front stairs, and instead he just turns to her, puts out his hand and says, I think you must be Margaret, the new cook. Welcome, I hope you'll be very happy with us. Of course, that's just straightforward good behaviour, but I think it's interesting that after years in service it was the first time she'd encountered it. You know, no one had ever spoken to her like that before.
Tell us some bad stories then you heard that broke your heart when you heard them.
Oh, there were some awful sort of stories of meanness. I think a lot of employers had servants that they couldn't really afford to keep. Mm. It wasn't the wages, because wages and the labour in those days was quite cheap. It was the feeding them. The food was very expensive, and laundering clothes and things. So you had awful stories of employers sort of locking everything in the kitchen so the servants don't even steal a crust of bread, you know, and counting the grains of rice virtually to make sure they aren't taking anything more than their share, and special, you know, special food for them that's always cheap and old. And so there's a lot of that kind of thing, a sort of general meanness. There was one story by Jean Rennie, which is sort of, it's sort of awful, but it's almost too eccentric to be really. And it's the Jean Rennie was a housemaid in the 20s, and she worked for an old bachelor who lived in some vast house, but was obsessively stingy. And he used to very magnanimously give the servants a Christmas pudding at Christmas with a sixpence inside. And then whoever found the sixpence had to give it back to him for next year.
Oh,
God. It was ridiculously. And he used to count the sardines in the tins as well to make sure that they weren't taking more than their share.
What about the thing about them having to turn round? Was that quite common?
I think that was common in large houses. Mm. I don't think there was really room to do it in small houses. Mm. But if you could, large houses were often built so that servants could disappear. Because the whole idea of these, I mean, the great sort of flowering of the English country house, which was famous all over the world, this incredible hospitality, everything running on oiled wheels, like now, I suppose, a terribly, terribly grand hotel, was that you never saw it happening. The soap was always fresh, the flowers were always fresh, the matchboxes were always filled to the brim, and you never saw any work being done.
Backstairs, they trod very quietly.
So you saw all these, yes, they had special shoes. Manufacturers made special shoes for servants that were elasticated at the sides so they didn't squeak.
Wow.
And it was, there were lots of sort of rules about servants cultivating these very low voices, so that very, very, you know, that rather servantly, that, you know, that way Carson talks when he's talking to Lord Grantham. It's very carefully modulated, so it's nothing is loud or raucous.
Yeah, it wouldn't bother them. Yeah.
Yes, everything is quiet, and a lot of houses had sort of hidden doors, especially on stairways, where you could dart in if you saw anyone coming. But if you were caught, in a lot of houses, you were ordered to turn your face to the wall if you were a maid. Not, I think, if you were an upper servant. I think not perhaps if you were a footman or a butler, but if you were a housemaid.
That expression, the green baize door, what does that mean?
Well, that came in the 19th century, when architecture increasingly drew up a separation between the family and the servants. In the 18th century, everyone used to share the same space. You know, the servants would quite often sleep in their master's bedrooms. You know, it was just a very different. But in the 19th century, you get this idea of sort of two communities under one roof. So you get the beginning of backstairs, tradesmen's entrances, mm-hmm. you know, not going in the front door, basements, all this kind of thing. That's all very 19th century. And the Green Baize Door is part of that. And that is the separation between the servants' quarters and the family quarters. And the baize was to get rid of smells. It was thought that the baize, they absorbed smell, so you didn't get the smell of cooking, especially in a small house where you were quite near the kitchen. They were always obsessed by not having the smell of cooking or the smell of gas, because gas was the new form of lighting, but it was considered a bit naff. So you had it for the servants so they could work late, but it was very smelly. So the Green Baize Door was kept the smell of gas out.
In history, you touched on it then. Have we always had this unequal relationship?
Well, I don't think so. I think, again, that's slightly a 19th century thing. I mean, of course it's unequal. If someone is a maid sleeping at the end of your bed on the floor, she is clearly, the relationship is unequal, because there's economic inequality is hardly new. But I think that for the 19th century, there became this obsession with drawing a line between the employer and the servant. So you get the beginning of uniforms. And in the 18th century, they had livery. Footmen had livery, but they were really flash. You know, they were fantastic, and they often set the fashion. But you didn't have uniformed women, for example. I mean, a kitchen maid wouldn't be uniformed.
Yeah.
But I think that in the 19th century, it became terribly important that there should be a division that was very marked, so that no one would ever mistake your maid for your daughter.
So it really is the beginning of the class divide, isn't it?
Well, it's the beginning of a sort of wanting the class divide to be obvious. And I think that's partly because in the 19th century, a lot of class divides were actually breaking down. You know, the Industrial Revolution, there was a lot of new money around. The whole thing about class became rather tense.
Yes.
You know, so that if you were newly rich, you didn't, well, you know, you wanted
out.
Absolutely,
yeah.
You didn't want your housemaid to be as well dressed as your daughter. And then you get this whole thing about servant women wearing special bonnets in church, which was one of the most resented things of all servants that I read about, was this idea that you weren't even in church allowed to wear what you liked.
RadioGorgeous.com.
So the start of a modern age was the First World War. Did things change after that?
Well, they did, but not as much, I think, as people often think, and certainly not very much for servants, because although, as Rose Harrison, who's Lady Astor's maid, said, it was a time of women's lib below stairs. You know, a lot of women left service to go and work as bus conductors or in factories or munitions. After the war, for many reasons, a lot of women very reluctantly were forced back into service. And part of this, that there was a massive economic depression, so there was very little employment, and a lot of men were laid off, so women had to go to work. That was one big reason. And the other thing, I think, was an idea that you had these the men who had suffered in the war, that there was a very sort of profound feeling that women shouldn't be taking jobs from men that men could do, and also that women, the home became terribly, terribly important. You know, it became a sort of bastion against the awful things that had happened, and it was as if men had to be rewarded by these wonderful sort of old-fashioned middle-class homes to come back to. And this rotted very deep, so while middle-class women were enjoying for the first time, they could vote, they could go to university, they could join the civil service, they were more independent than they had ever been, working-class girls were forced back into service. And so by 1930, there were actually more women in service than there had been in 1900.
I suppose also, because you say, because there weren't men in it doing it, were there?
No, men were not going. I mean, gradually the decline of male servants. I mean,
because you think of a 1930s image of a girl with a little white hat on and with a tea tray, don't you? You know
that well exactly. And men. I mean, there were still men. There were still valets and there were still butlers, but there weren't.
It wasn't like it's so much a career, and there was loads of them doing it. And yeah.
Yes, and I mean, and they were often. I mean, they were often forced back. They were often had been batmen in the war. They were ex-servicemen. A lot of ex-servicemen became manservants, you know.
Yeah, I suppose it kind of, again, there used to be hierarchy, there used to be deference.
Yes, and they're quite often, it's Bates in Downton Abbey is a very good example of that. Mm. He's had a very good war. He's been a distinguished soldier, but he's at home with that sort of officer-squaddy divide, I think is very interesting. And it holds true today, in fact, because... I went to interview the people at the Greycoat Agency in Victoria, which is the big sort of old-fashioned domestic service agency. Mm-hmm. And they, a lot of the slots that they fill for modern butlers and men, sort of chauffeur, handyman type words, are ex-servicemen.
Wow.
They're very and they're very popular with employers who can afford them.
They've learned to take rules. They can, you know, they, and they're
very.
Order.
They're often very, very disciplined.
Yeah.
They're extremely keen on tidy, neat. They like
yes,
you know
yeah,
that
they're polishing
they like
their boots,
all that,
yeah.
And they're very they're very at home with the sort of keeping of order, and they're very popular.
It's fascinating. God, that must have been so interesting, that part of your job. Having a servant, parlourmaid, lady maid, was a sign of respectability. If you're middle class, you couldn't even open your own front door, could you?
No, it was a sign of status. I mean, to have someone, what they call front of house, to have someone sort of as a mediating between you and the outside world, I think. So, and you get this system of calling cards that goes on, you know, for an incredibly long time, I mean, until after the First World War, by which people leave a card, and the card is left with it's taken by the maid on a tray, because interestingly you can't ever touch the card with your fingers. Oh, this is something I learned, which I found completely fascinating, because the card was a representation of the physical presence of the person. So to touch the card would be like actually touching the person who'd given the card, which of course would have been terribly rude. So the card was put on a tray and taken to the employer, the master or the mistress, and she then was permitted to touch the card and took it off the tray.
Fascinating. And is that probably why they wore gloves and things as well?
Yes, I think that was part of it. Exactly. Yeah, it's not touching and not sort of smearing.
Yeah.
And again, I think that must have furthered this idea of inequality, that you're sort of not permitted to have any sort of real human contact with your employer's world.
Now, after the First World War, lots of houses closed, were knocked down. You know, even though, as you say, servants went on, the kind of the big country houses were in, you know, trauma. And also there were a lot of kind of women who were kind of casualties of the war. They couldn't get a husband. They might be a spinster. They might be upper class or middle class, but they're on their uppers.
Yes.
So they might even become a what's it called, a lady maid?
Well, there was it is interesting. I mean, throughout history, there is this very sad creature. Well, unfortunately, till now, thank goodness, who is the sort of the woman born into genteel poverty. And I do think when, you know, times when one might be nostalgic for the past, it seems to me there are two things that should stop that. One is dentistry, and the other one is the prospect of actually being genteel but poor. Mm-hmm. Because, your prospects of getting a husband were low, and you had to earn your living, but you weren't really educated for anything. And you certainly weren't educated for manual labour, which would have made you sought after as a maid, which was lowly, but at least it was proper work. I mean,
yeah,
it was employment.
Like you said,
So you then, your options were things like governess or companion. And those were so lonely, because you were never accepted in the servants' hall, and you were never really accepted by your employers either. So you had this awful in-between lonely life. And I can't tell you how many books I read about, you know, the companion, who's this lonely middle-aged woman who's been looking after her parents. When they die, She hasn't got enough money to live on her own. She's completely unsupported. The state, even if she would ever have had allowed herself to ask for it, had nothing. There was no protection for her at all. So she becomes the companion of some sort of rancorous old woman who she reads to. And it really was a terrible life. So in the 20s, the prospects changed for women like that. And it is one of the really lovely things that the setting up of Universal Aunts, which I wrote about in the book, was tremendously heartening. It was set up by an upper-class woman called Gertie McLean, who saw that there were spare women, women who were widowed by the war, whose fiancés had been lost, or women who were never, ever going to have a chance to marry because there weren't the men. And women who had skills that they'd learnt in war work, you know, who had perhaps been running canteens and for the first time had sort of learnt things that they could use.
Yeah, nursing or... Yeah.
Exactly. So she sets up this agency, which is really the beginning of what we would now, and in fact it's still going, very thriving, but it's what we would now think of as sort of outsourced domestic labour. So it's, you know, dog walking, flower arranging, yes, you know, doing a dinner party.
Wow.
And for a lot of the new rich, there were a lot of new poor in the 20s,
yeah,
and there were also a lot of new rich. Mm-hmm. And the new rich quite often wanted guidance in how to do things.
Oh.
So the new poor, so a lot of these women sort of stepped in,
yeah,
to help out, to show them how to give a dinner party or show them how to treat their servants, which was another thing, you know.
Fascinating,
isn't it? And so that a lot of prospects opened up for women.
Mm.
And that was very heartening, because sometimes when I was writing the book, I used to look at the 1920s and feel rather gloomy. I think, oh, God, it must have been absolutely awful for those poor girls. And then, but I do think that at the other side of that, for another kind of woman, a world was opening up. And eventually, after the Second World War, it opened up for all women.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the beginning of it.
Yes. Was the servant relationship something that only really happened to the British? You know, this sort of keeping them apart and the baize door. And...
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know very much. I think about other nations and the, I mean, certainly Americans remarked on the difference when they came to Britain. They remarked on the sort of style, but people were very seduced by it, as you know. I mean, that is why Upstairs Downstairs has been the most watched television programme in history all over the world.
What?
Because it seems in some way those sort of hierarchies speak to every single society. A friend of mine was working in Juba in South Sudan, and she was at the airport, and all these people were, crowds of people were sort of rushing past her, elbowing her out of the way, and she thought there must be some crisis, and they were all running towards this television, where they showed on a loop sort of reruns of Upstairs Downstairs. And... So I think that in some way, I think we did it quite well. I think we were seen as doing it quite well. We were seen as sort of maintaining an idea of a sort of social pyramid, which was also a duty of care at best. And of course, Americans had inequality built in the black-white difference.
Yeah.
There would have been a sort of ethnic difference in the States, which... Well, we didn't have, because we didn't have that society. But
we did have a British Empire. Do you think that gave us imperiousness? You know, made us feel like during Victorian times, it's like, well, we're so important, we can treat people like this, we can, you know, have a divide. Sort of.
I don't think so. I don't think so. And I think, funnily enough, our attitude towards the empire was slightly like, at best, our attitude towards servants, is that there was this rather upper class English idea that we were enlightened and we were bringing enlightenment to the lower orders. And that's not just the lower orders class wise, that's the lower orders of nations, you know.
Yeah.
We're bringing development.
Yes, yes.
So I think that that is something we find very difficult now, but it was born out of something that's not entirely not virtuous. I think it's, you know, it's a mixed, it's because it's infantilizing to the object of your help, but I think it brings with it certain sort of duties of care, which you would not find, I think, in some other forms of employment in that period.
Britain famously has bad service in restaurants now and like hotels you go to in the country. And British people do hate to serve. I mean, they do have an attitude problem. Do you think this goes back to those days?
Yes, I do think. I think there's a real dislike. I think the whole idea of service has sunk into the collective memory as being demeaning. Because, I mean, an awful lot of people come from people in service. I mean, most people will have had someone
in
service.
I've got a great-granny and they were in a house in Wiltshire, yeah.
Well, you would be common of absolutely dozens of people who... and I think that memory is a difficult one for us. We just... We find it very difficult now to see the value in it.
Yes.
Which is why we now have this rather complicated thing, is that we don't mind, on the whole, I mean, this royal we, but as a society, we find it easier to employ foreigners
as
domestic servants than we do, because I think the class thing is not so acute. But of course, that in a way is an injustice in itself, isn't it? That's because I think an awful sort of other injustices slip under the radar.
I hate to say, but, you know, the people I've had, you know, have worked harder than maybe the English people have employed.
Well, they don't have perhaps that kind of collective memory of it, that it's demeaning. I mean, I think we do... I mean, even after the Second World War, there was a woman called Pearl Jeffson, who was a sociologist, and she did lots of surveys of working-class girls. And she asked them, many of whom were unemployed, and she asked them if they would go into service because there was a great demand. People wanted maids, but they couldn't get them. And she said it was they would rather have died than gone into service. By that time, it meant something that had so completely disappeared. It meant injustice and degradation.
Fascinating to have you today on Radio Gorgeous. And if you want to buy Servants, it's published by Bloomsbury. And I just want to point out that you won the 2002 Blue Peter Award for non-fiction. Now, we are so impressed here at Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I must say that was a very, very proud moment for me.
Thanks so much for coming on.
It was a pleasure.